Welcome to TechNet Radio, your guide to the IT universe.
Hi, and welcome back to TechNet Radio. I'm Aurora Queen, and today is May 8th, 2007. We have a big show for you today, so let's jump right in. First, I'd like to introduce the new TechNet Radio producer, Eric Ostrowski. I'll be moving into a new position as TechNet Content Manager, and I've enjoyed working on TechNet Radio and feel very confident handing it off to Eric. I also want to extend a big thanks to you for listening. So with that, Eric, take it away.
Hey, thanks, Aurora. I've been producing webcasts for the last 3 years, focusing mostly on security, so I'm looking forward to taking this on. I'm really interested in hearing what topics you want to have on this show, so email tnradio@microsoft.com or leave a message at 877-814-6506. Today on the show, Matt Hester talks with David Lowe about Longhorn workload scenarios. Plus, we have the monthly segment with Kai Axford and Mark Riesi from the Security Response Team discussing the May security updates. First, here's Matt Hester talking with David Lowe on TechNet Radio.
Good morning, good afternoon, or good evening. Thank you for tuning in to TechNet Radio. My name is Matt Hester. I'm a senior IT pro evangelist with the TechNet events team. So I travel around the country doing events across America. Today I have an exciting interview. We're going to talk some more about Longhorn. I have David Lowe on an interview with us today. David, why don't you tell a little bit about yourself?
Hi, Matt. It's good to be here with you today. I'm senior product manager in the Windows Server division, and I specifically have responsibility for Windows Server codename Longhorn.
So what kind of responsibilities, David? What do you actually do? Are we going to come up with a new name, or what kind of things do you actually get into the technical bolts about?
Oh, we'll definitely be coming up with a new name. We'll have to figure something like that out to make sure we have a nice, exciting new version of Windows Server for people to actually start working with. On the responsibility side, I'm looking after some of the launch planning activities worldwide and also getting ready for evaluation and deployment programs so that customers can actually begin testing, evaluating, and deploying the product even before we release.
So you want the folks to go out at the end of this radio interview. Of course, they would have got to listen to the whole thing, but you want them to get the betas as soon as they can, correct?
Absolutely. We'll want them to download them or order a CD or a DVD online or go out and buy a magazine if they see it attached to the front cover, pick it up in their supermarket or at an event or wherever we happen to be distributing it.
So let's talk a little bit about Beta 3 and what are some of the things, when we look at it from a deployment standpoint, we have some great role kind of based deployment scenarios. What was the main reason for looking at those role based scenarios?
Well, that's a great point, because when customers start to install Windows Server Longhorn and they get to the end of that installation process, one of the first things that they'll be able to do is run an add roles wizard where they'll get to add server roles. And as you say, you'll notice that we do have this role-based deployment in the product. And the main reason for that is because that is the way customers think about their servers. They think about having file servers, having print servers, having web servers, domain controllers, network access protection servers, terminal servers. So everything for them and everything that they do is based around a role. So everything that we've tried to do in the product is based around the same server roles.
What are some of the server roles customers can expect to see when they roll this out? Obviously, we're taking away, kind of giving them the all-in-one server. What kind of roles? Are we talking about a web server? Are we talking about terminal services or all of the above? What kind of roles are you looking at when people deploy it?
Absolutely. You could probably break the roles into sort of three kind of main sets. We have identity and access management related roles. So they're all the ones that will appear at the top of the list with Active Directory at the beginning of their name. So we have much better integration between all the various identity related roles now. So there's Active Directory Domain Services, which is the new name for Domain Controller, Active Directory Certificate Services, Active Directory Rights Management Services. So a whole bunch of roles related to identity. Then, of course, there are the more traditional infrastructure roles. So there's file, there's DNS, DHCP, Network Access Services. And then, of course, there are more application platform specific roles. So you can think about just, the application server role, where you might have the .NET Framework 3.0 installed for your next generation server applications and web services. There's the web server role, which is IIS version 7, and other application-specific roles, and maybe like terminal services, which has a new terminal server remote app capability. maybe Windows SharePoint services as well. So they're kind of the three main areas in which we can break those out.
So definitely when customers see this, they'll be kind of be able to select, hey, very specific to role. So did that come from requests from customers out there that are listening to this radio interview, or did we kind of make a decision to say, hey, let's make this a little bit easier to manage, let's get rid of some of the possible attack service that may be on the server, just some reasons that come off the top of my head, or some reasons behind driving this decision?
Oh, definitely. It's all based around customer input. I have to say that customer and partner input has never been higher for any of our server releases, and that's really what we've been looking at to try and drive both the feature set and the overall quality bar for Windows Server Longhorn. So as I said, we know that customers think about deploying their servers in this role-based way, and so that's why we've tried to make not just the deployment, but also the management of the server more role-based as well.
Yeah, and I've seen the new Server Manager console, and I'll tell you what, folks, if you haven't had a chance, when you get a hold of beta, that's going to be one of the first things that pops up to let you play with. It's a one-stop shop for all the management folks. It's role-based management as well. It's an incredible utility. So
in fact, it actually is the first thing that does pop up after you start the server, literally.
So, and I'm telling you what, it's one of those things I joked with Ian McDonald a little bit ago when we did an interview about, hey, that looks a lot like small business server management, but I'll tell you from a standpoint, folks, it's new technology and it's rock solid. It's phenomenal. And I had a lot of fun I actually get to show people how to use the utility. So it's a lot of really nice things. So when I heard those kind of three things, or those three role areas, you know, identity, access, infrastructure, and application, you know, and you talk about Active Directory, a couple have popped up. I mean, we've been really solid with Active Directory, and IIS 7, I've heard nothing but great things in terminal services, but let's kind of take these one at a time, and what kind of things have we done with Active Directory to really make it even better than what it's been in the past? Because I would say, you know what, we've been doing really good in that department. What have we done to kind of take it to the next step?
That's true, Matt. I mean, Active Directory is the most widely deployed identity and access and directory services technology that's out there. And you'd almost think, well, what more could we do with it to make it better? Well, we've been thinking about the way that people manage their directory services, both in smaller businesses and then also in larger enterprise-sized businesses where maybe they have remote offices. And what we've tried to do is we've thought about how maybe there are these remote offices, or sometimes called branch offices, where people could be separated from, you know, the centralized office, maybe by a slow wide area network connection. And sometimes that can be tough on those employees that are working in those locations, because maybe they don't have a great experience in terms of being able to authenticate and access resources and applications as easily. So for Active Directory in Windows Server Longhorn, we've implemented something called the read-only domain controller. And this is a way in which administrators will be able to put a domain controller in a remote office that will service these local authentication requests. But at the same time, because it's a read-only domain controller, and it's one that only replicates and caches information based on a policy that the administrator sets, we're able to provide a good authentication experience for those remote employees without maybe taking a hit on security by having a local copy of the full directory database in that remote office with maybe passwords being cached on the server. So we can actually say that we don't want passwords cached on the server. And then because it's not a full replication partner, we're not sending around an entire copy of the database across these slow wide area network connection links. We're only actually caching the information that's relevant to the people working actually in those remote offices. So we think that will be a great experience for those remote employees, and then also for the administrators that are trying to manage these larger distributed enterprise-wide networks.
It allows us all that benefit of why we want to have localized server without having the violation of the security or having a local directory there, because traditionally customers don't secure that branch office as much as they secure their corporate headquarters offices. So I think that's a phenomenal improvement that we have. Tell me a little bit about IIS7. I've heard a lot of really good things about it, but I want to hear it from the source. What do you think is really going to drive some of the, you know, not only the infrastructure, the IT folks out of there, what do you think, from their perspective, their application developers are going to get out of that IIS7 wave?
I'd have to say, Matt, that I think IIS7 is nearly my favorite role. I mean, it's tough with so many really, really cool roles to actually pick a favorite, but I think I'd probably have to go with IIS7 as the one that just pips the post. Because, as you say, we have great features both for IT professionals. So for people that are actually administering the servers, we've got a great new IIS 7 manager console. It's built on Microsoft Management Console 3.0. It's very task-based. There are these modules that are very easy to find and organize. And in fact, it's very easy to customize and extend the functionality of that console as well. So if you don't like one of the modules we've given you, maybe for setting up server certificates, or maybe, you know, setting up, you know, web server bindings, or maybe doing other kind of feature delegation stuff, you know, you can actually create your own module or extend the functionality of it. And that's because we have much tighter integration with .NET. So from an administrator's standpoint, not only do you have this really cool management interface, and in fact also it works over HTTPS, so it's also your same remote management interface as well, no separate web-based administration tool. But one of the things that we've done is we've allowed server administrators to delegate administration to maybe a website developer or a site owner. So sometimes you've got, as a server administrator, maybe a server with hundreds or even thousands of servers that you have to manage, and you know that the folks that have actually put that site together are much better able and much better positioned to be able to make some of those more feature-level decisions around, you know, how that site should work. So you can actually, as an administrator, delegate the ability to change those features and delegate the responsibility for being able to upload and modify the site content and the site configuration. And when I say the site configuration, that's an important point too, because we no longer have a metabase in IIS. Instead, now we're using config files that many web server administrators and also ASP.NET developers will be familiar with. So you can actually now upload or deploy site content and site configuration at the same time. And one of the cool things that that provides, as well as being able to do straightforward Xcopy deployment, is you can actually put the site content and configuration information on a shared folder and have multiple web servers in a web farm all point to the same central server in order to get their content and configuration. So if you need to make any changes, you can just make the changes at that one location, and boom, everything happens right across the entire web server farm. So lots of really cool stuff there for administrators. And then for developers, the tighter integration with .NET is something that will jump right out at them. Much easier for them to be able to customize the web server functionality, as I mentioned. We've got full integration with .NET Framework 3.0 and Windows Communications Foundation for being able to create great distributed applications that take advantages of web services. And of course, we know that sometimes, hey, websites don't necessarily behave the way we want them to, and applications can sometimes have problems. So we've got a really cool feature now called failed request event tracing, which means that you can specify the types of errors that you want to trap. And then if anything goes wrong on the site, you can have very, very detailed tracing logs that can help a developer to see exactly maybe where something went wrong.
Oh, that's fantastic stuff. I think I heard a collective cheer when people said we got rid of the meta database out there. I'm not sure if that's what I was hearing. So, David, that sounds like a lot of great things in IIS 7. I'm sure when people get a hold of the beta, they're going to definitely want to play with that, especially around that central site config files, to be able to have that one location to change their entire web farm. That's huge. Another one you brought up there I want to talk a little bit about is terminal services. I've actually had a chance to play with this, and I have to tell you, David, when I was able to drag a file off my desktop into a terminal services session and impact change, to me that was just remarkably awesome. Can you talk about some of the other things that are there that are fantastic about terminal services?
Yeah, I mean, that's I have to say that's pretty cool as well. It's funny how we can get so excited about things like just dragging files off the desktop.
Just copying and pasting files. I mean, it makes us happy.
No, I know. And that's one of the kind of things that we've been aiming for, again, with terminal services, is this more seamless experience. First of all, in terms of providing a seamless experience, we know that, I mean, hey, you think about the network perimeter these days, and, well, the network perimeter isn't really as well-defined as it used to be. You've got people, you know, accessing the network from home, from internet cafes, from, you know, machines that they, you know, are accessing in hotels or other places. They're bringing their laptops on the road with them. And people want to have that kind of seamless connectivity experience where they're able to use the applications they're used to using every day, whether they're locally installed applications they have on a laptop or maybe line of business applications that perhaps they access over the web or through a terminal services connection. And if you're out on the road and you need to be able to access one of these internal resources, it's a bit of a pain to have to go and create a virtual private network all the time. So Terminal Services Gateway is a great new feature whereby you can set up a Terminal Services Gateway on the edge. And what happens is when a client tries to connect to a terminal server, it can actually specify the name of a Terminal Services Gateway. And what happens is that the RDP protocol, the remote desktop protocol, gets packaged up in secure HTTP so that it can be sent over the internet and through, you know, all the various, you know, network access devices that are out there on the internet, and quickly and easily get to that terminal server gateway where the HTTPS will be stripped off and the remote desktop protocol will be passed through to the internal terminal servers. Think about it like the way we have RPC running over HTTP today for, you know, Outlook 2003 and Outlook 2007 against Exchange Server. So that'll provide a nice kind of seamless connection experience that's also, of course, you know, more secure for people that are out in a remote location. And then if they want to be able to run an application that maybe they don't have installed locally, I mean, it could be, you know, a Microsoft Office application that they don't have, or it could be some custom line of business application. We provide a way now through Terminal Services Remote App for them to be able to fire up a terminal server connection just to that application. And it operates as if it was locally installed. It sits there in a window. They can drag it around. Like you said, they can drag files into that application window as if it were a locally installed application. We can even do file extension mapping. So, hey, let's say it was something like Microsoft Office Visio. I'm out on the road. Somebody sends me a Visio document as an attachment, and I don't have Microsoft Office Visio installed in my local machine. I can double-click on that .vsd file, and if that terminal server remote app had been deployed to my machine, then it will know to go and create a terminal services connection back to the server where Microsoft Office Visio has been installed, and I can run it in a window there just as if I had it right there locally on my machine.
Oh, that's fantastic. And with RDP being so streamlined, it helps work with some of those larger documents, could be even potentially better than having it locally owned.
Yeah, and I mean, you don't even need to have anything installed on the client at all. Well, okay, you do have to have the Remote Desktop Protocol 6.0 client. I mean, that's built into Windows Vista, and we're going to be making it available for Windows XP Service Pack 2 as well. But you don't even need to have anything installed. You can even just visit a web portal and see a list of published applications and just, you know, click the icon right in there on the web page. There could be, you know, 10, 100, 1,000 applications published, and you can just fire it up right there from the web page.
Oh, that's fantastic. And especially one of the things that I was playing with, I actually shared Server Manager across the wire via this, folks. And basically, I had my remote management solution right there, and I didn't have to worry about loading an admin pack or any of those additional things, because Server Manager was an application that actually showed up in my list to be able to share. So I could centrally manage from a terminal server session. And folks, it was very, very easy to configure and set up.
Hey, that's not a bad idea, because I mean, the Server Manager is for managing a local server. So if you want to manage your remote server, that's certainly one way to do it. Fire up a terminal services connection, you know, to that server machine, and you know, have the Server Manager published as an application. Yeah, good idea.
Yeah, it was, and I'm telling you what, folks, it just flat out works, especially in some of the early betas I've been playing with. I mean, it's just phenomenal code. I'll tell you one of the things that's been really exciting to the customers have been seeing, David, especially from security side. One of the things we've been talking about is the network access protection and the NAP functionalities. And I do a real simple demo of, hey, I turn the firewall off and it gets turned right back on again. And people just really, really like that. What kind of other aspects have you been seeing customers use around NAP, or what kind of other things are exciting you and our customer base about NAP?
Well, network access protection, of course, is another example of policy-based networking and the way we've really beefed up policies in policy-based control in Windows Server Longhorn. So it's up to the administrator to define the policy that they want to be enforced when you have clients connecting to the network, and that's over a wired or a wireless connection, whether they're a domain joined machine or a non-domain joined machine, whether it's coming in by requesting a DHCP IP address, whether it's trying to create an 802.1x connection or a virtual private network. Hey, you can even have network access protection working over Terminal Services Gateway. So if somebody's off there in an internet cafe and they're trying to connect through Terminal Services Gateway, we can even have network access protection enforced at that point. And it provides for a way for you to enforce a certain level of compliance, as you say. And that could be making sure the Windows firewall is on. It could be making sure that all critical updates have been installed, or that antivirus signatures or other anti-malware software is up to date on the machine. But because it just builds on server and domain isolation, which is something that, you know, we've been touting since Windows Server 2003 first came out, using IPsec, it's also even just a great way for people to provide guest internet access. Maybe if you've got partners or consultants that are visiting, you know, your corporate location and they want to be able to log onto the internet, you know, you can do that by implementing this server and domain isolation policy and using network access services, so that you can make sure that those connecting clients are A, not unhealthy and not going to potentially put any kind of malicious software onto your network, but B, you can specify exactly what kind of access they have and how limited that access should be, and that's what network access protection provides.
So let me just clarify something. I think I just heard, I want to make sure I heard it correctly, because if it is, it's wickedly cool, is that we can actually check a kiosk computer. So somebody be running to their plane trying to hop online, and if that computer doesn't meet our security requirements of our corporation, we won't let them into our corporate network. Is that correct?
That's
right. Is that kind of what I just heard?
That is correct. We can determine exactly what level of access. So we could put them onto a particular subnet where maybe the only access they have is to a server that holds, you know, antivirus updates. If we determine they don't have the appropriate antivirus updates, or other critical updates that we think that machine should have before being able to access any network resources.
And that's amazing. I mean, that's one way. I mean, think about kiosks are good functionality, but I think traditionally it's probably scared some administrators because you don't know what's on that system, or if it has been updated or if it is infected. Now we can kind of enforce to make sure they're coming in a secure fashion into our environment.
And it's important to remember as well, it's not just at that connection point, because network access protection provides ongoing compliance. Like you said there with that demo, you know, the client is already connected to the network. They turn the Windows firewall off and we turn it straight back on again because we're continually monitoring to ensure that those client computers are actually staying in compliance with the policy.
Yeah, and I'm telling you what, folks, the trick to this is that it's fairly straightforward to deploy, but the trick is defining your policy. What is your policy going to look like to enforce? And then define how you're going to help remediate the people that become unhealthy or are unhealthy when they join that network. And I'm telling you what, that's where all the magic is. Have you run into a lot of customers been playing with this in the early betas at all? Have you heard any unique things that they're doing with their policies?
We do have a number of customers that are already in something that we call our NAPTAP. And NAPTAP is the Network Access Protection Technology Adoption Program. And we've had a technology adoption program running for some time now, over a year, in fact, where customers are actually deploying Windows Server Longhorn, you know, the associated technologies, in production environments, in their live environments. So they're already betting their business on a number of the technologies, features, and roles that we've built into Windows Server Longhorn. And, yeah, we do have a number of customers that are using NAP already today, both with Windows XP machines and Windows Vista machines. And, yeah, some of them are doing some pretty cool stuff. I mean, we do have, you know, one customer actually that's looking to provide a way for people that are just coming in off the street to be able to they're actually kind of like a sort of a museum-type thing. And people that are just coming in off the street, they want to be able to provide them with tablet PCs that provides online interactive guides. And they're actually looking to ensure that those tablet PCs are using NAP to make sure that they're protected.
Yeah, so somebody can't put something bad on there that could possibly infect that entire network. I mean, it's great we can give people that functionality, and for the most part, people are going to take advantage, but we want to make sure we protect against that person that really wants to try to get a hold of the network in not nice ways.
Exactly.
Oh, those are phenomenal things. So one of the things I want to talk about, and we've kind of been going through all these different roles, and thank you for your time. I think there's a lot of things to excite folks and some things I want to take a look at as well, especially around IIS. But one of the things I've been working with, and this one seems to be kind of definitely changing in the betas, but where's this core server? I've played with it. It came up, and I'm telling you what, when I saw the command prompt come up, David, I went, hey, where's my window? Can you tell me a little bit about the core server and what it's all about?
Sure. So you got a bit of a surprise when you saw the command prompt and thought maybe you'd jumped in your time machine.
Yep.
You thought, hey, what happened to the WoW? The WoW has stopped. So server core is an idea that comes about, again, building on us thinking about the way that customers actually deploy their servers. And again, with input from customers and partners, they've said, hey, you know, when we deploy a server, we tend to deploy it in a very specific kind of configuration, and it has a given role, and it just sits there and it provides these services. And a lot of the times in these larger enterprises, or even in small, some smaller companies, they're going to be deploying a server, and they're never going to actually go over and sit down in front of it and kind of log on and, you know, start doing stuff on the server. It's almost like a set it and forget it type thing. And if they do need to provide any kind of management or maintenance service, they'll probably use third-party or Microsoft management software, which typically will run remotely. So in thinking about that, we said, wouldn't it be great if we gave customers a new installation option? So let's say they're deploying Windows Server Enterprise or Windows Server Data Center, and we said, hey, here's an installation option such that if you already know ahead of time that this is going to be one of those servers that's going to be running one of a set number of roles, or maybe have one of a set number of features installed, and you want to be able to set it and forget it and just kind of walk away and not have to think too much about ongoing management and maintenance, well, there's a whole bunch of stuff you probably don't actually need to have running locally on that server. And we're talking about things like, well, graphical applications. The server manager tool is, you know, without doubt, one of the best things that we've done on Windows Server Longhorn, but it's used for local management of a server. And if you're not going to be doing any local management of that server, well, you don't need the server manager. Likewise, you don't need Internet Explorer or even Windows Explorer. So effectively, we've taken away all these graphical applications and the underlying graphical user interface and Windows Shell. And in that situation, you're going to have a server that still has all the underlying networking subsystem, file subsystem, security subsystems. They're still all going to be there in terms of that core functionality of the server. Plus, there are a number of roles, of course, that you can install on top of that. But all the management you do is going to be done remotely. So you can still fire up Active Directory users and computers, or, you know, the file server resource manager. You can still fire those up in the management console on a different machine and connect to your server core installation and do the same kind of management that you always did. But, you know, realistically, you just don't need to have those things actually running on the local server core installation itself.
So this may even help extend the lifetime of some of the older legacy servers that maybe not have the graphics capabilities to support the GUI. We can give them a kind of a nice truck-down version that can still have a lot of full functionality without having to have the need for some of the horsepower that we might need on some of our other servers. Would that be accurate?
It's true that certainly customers might find they get a bit more life out of some of their server hardware by opting for a server core installation, but really the main value is in having to perform far fewer updates. Because if you think about it, the fewer components that are physically present and installed on that server, well, of course, that reduces the attack surface for the server, but it also just reduces the overall management surface, because fewer components means fewer components that might ever need an update, and fewer components that might ever need an update means less management, maintenance, and fewer reboots, so better reliability and security all around.
Oh, that's awesome. And I'm telling you what, folks, yeah, don't be scared the first time it comes up. It's exactly how it's supposed to be. A nice little blinking cursor is going to be at you in the environment that we have. So, David, we talked a lot about the server core. Do you think that some of the OEMs, just kind of a future here, do you think some of them might turn those into blade servers? Do you think we'll ever get to that, or do you think we're there now?
That's an interesting question, Matt. I think that's something that OEMs definitely might look at. We, of course, are talking to OEMs about different ways in which they can, you know, pre-install or, you know, help customers to deploy Windows Server Longhorn. And, you know, we already have some OEMs that, you know, do provide kind of, you know, pre-installed and pre-configured versions of Windows Server. And if this was just another installation option that we provide and another installation option that they decide to provide, well, of course, we'll help them do whatever is going to be right for the customer.
That's awesome, and I'm telling you what, folks, if you get a chance to play with it, you definitely want to take a look at Core and set up a little mini environment. Lots of learning to be had on how we deploy it. Well, David, that's all the questions I kind of had, and that's all the time we have today on this. But I definitely want to thank you for your time, sitting down and talking with you about Longhorn Server. David, any last words for the folks out there listening?
No, you hit the nail right on the head. We want customers to go out there, to download it, order it, pick it up wherever they see it, and start testing it, evaluating it, and, of course, deploying it. So thanks again, Matt, for your time. It's been great talking to you.
No problem. Thank you. And once again, thank you, everybody, for tuning in and checking out. This is Matt Hester with TechNet Radio.
That was Matt Hester talking with David Lowe about Longhorn workload scenarios. If you want to check out the Beta 3, just visit our website, Microsoft.com/TNRadio. Now, we listen to Kai Axford and Mark Riesi talk about the May security updates.
All right, everybody. We just want to welcome everyone to the May update, and we're going to be talking today about the releases that are coming out here shortly. Today I have Mark Riesi with me from Microsoft's Security Response Center, and he's going to be talking about the updates that are coming out, and we got some good news, some of the things you might have been hearing about, and they're getting resolved. So, Mark, you just want to jump in here quick and give a quick plug for what you do and what team you're on?
So, thanks, Kai. Hey folks, it is Update Tuesday for May, and we have this month 7 bulletins going out. All the bulletins are rated critical this month, and we have a total of 3 bulletins, MS-07, 023, 024, and 025 that address issues in Microsoft Office. 023 addresses an issue in Excel, 024 in Word, and 027 in the Office suite in general. We have another bulletin coming out for the Exchange server. This is MS-07026, and the vulnerability there is really critical. We have a security update for Internet Explorer coming out, as well as MS-07028, which is a Capcom issue, which we'll touch on a little more. And then finally, if you've been paying attention to our blogs the past few weeks, you would know that we have a vulnerability in RPC in the Windows DNS server, and that is being addressed in a bulletin, and that number is MS-07029.
Great. Okay. So let me ask you just quick overall. I believe that all the ones we're talking about today are all critical, correct?
That's correct. The highest level for the ones we're talking about today are critical. In some of those cases, they're not actually critical across the board on the products. Many of them are rated important, but on individual products that are affected, there is a rating of critical, which, of course, we always go with the highest rating regardless of the other vulns that are in there.
Right. And so all the updates that we're doing, how many total vulnerabilities are we mitigating with these updates?
So this month with the 7 bulletins, we are addressing 19 vulnerabilities.
Okay, well, that's good. And so let's go ahead and just dive right in here. Let's talk about the Exchange one, because we haven't had a lot of news in Exchange. Now, does this vulnerability with OWA, does it affect all flavors of Exchange, or is the new Exchange Server 2007 affected, or what were we talking about there?
Yeah, the what the vulnerability is basically a malformed image file, so a GIF file, if you will, can actually come across. And the way that if it's not put together properly, then it can cause an exception. And there is the potential for remote code execution. I do want to point out, though, that in doing the investigation around this, while this is rated critical, there haven't actually been any attacks on this. And this is something that, came in through a normal support call of just a system crash. So if folks do see this, it will appear as a message store crash in your system. So if you're seeing something like that, then you should check for this and make sure this update gets applied.
Okay, and that's good information, because I was looking through some of the information about these things, and I was really glad to see that most of these were disclosed through responsible disclosure and not through, I think one or two of them was released on the Internet, but for the most part, these were all disclosed responsibly to Microsoft.
That's correct, Kai. And we talk about this a lot, and I touched on this the past couple months, just how important responsible disclosure is to protecting customers out there and not shining a light on vulnerabilities and giving malicious folks out there a chance to exploit this before we have the opportunity to get some updates out and protect consumers.
Correct. Well, that's great because, again, that's real important. And I would say that, you know, any vendor that you're using, be it Microsoft or anyone else, if you did find a vulnerability or your researcher, then you need to go ahead and do the right thing and release that information and notify the vendor first before you try to, you know, a lot of people try to do that and release it to the public because they think that'll put heat on the vendor. And it really doesn't. And it just, you know, it just puts people at risk, which is what we're trying not to do as security people.
Yeah, that's correct, Kai. And we really can't stress that enough. This isn't just a Microsoft thing we're looking for. I mean, this is really across the board for all vendors. And we would encourage, you know, everyone, regardless of who it is and what you find, to tell that ISV first and give them a chance to fix the software. And keep in mind that, you know, there aren't unlimited resources for companies, you know, out there. And they do need a chance to fix their product.
Yep. Okay, let's talk a little about the DNS, because that's been a pretty hot topic. So you wanted to explain what exactly was going on with DNS and what we're doing to fix that?
Sure. So the DNS issue is one that was reported, and it was critical vuln that allowed for remote code execution. An attacker could do something to the stack to cause a buffer overrun, and this was done through RPC, or remote procedure call. And this is an interface in a lot of things, and it's just a way of sending data packets around. And if you did this to the DNS server, then you in essence could take control and actually execute something onto a system. What made this especially a hot topic, and why we took the approach to get folks very much informed about this, is that it is on the Windows server. So the DNS server, in case folks aren't really aware of what that is, that's basically how all of us get ourselves navigated around the internet and on corporate networks. It's all the addresses that are out there and kind of how we get sent from our browser to a website, if you will. Well, these services reside on servers. What made this especially interesting to attack is the fact that it actually can be installed on a domain controller. So in essence, what made this so critical is the fact that a DNS server that gets compromised actually could potentially be a domain server that gets compromised. And then that could have, much larger implications for enterprises if their domain controllers were compromised. So very key thing, we've obviously been trying to keep folks as informed as possible and encourage everyone to immediately get this fix tested in your environments, so whatever your process is, and get it deployed as quickly as possible.
Good. And that's real important. Like you said, DNS is, domain name resolution. And what, like you were saying, it just resolves the name, an IP address to a name. It resolves the name to an IP address so you can find it quicker. Because most people don't go in there and remember, 206.148.32.whatever. So it makes it a lot easier to just remember Microsoft.com. Okay, so the next one I want to talk about here a little bit is the CAPICOM. Let's start off by explaining what does CAPICOM stand for, and then we're going to talk a little bit about, I know it's, what does it stand for, cryptographic API COM?
Cryptographic
Application Programming Interface COM. Okay, Common Object Model. So again, CAPICOM is what everybody calls it. It has to do with cryptography. So let's explain what it is that we're actually, what the vulnerability or the risk is here that's been identified, and then let's talk about what we're doing to fix it.
You got it. So CAPICOM is that. So it's an API that we provide that allows software developers to do various types of encryption within their products. So if you had, let's say, a product that, I'll give you an easy example, that maybe is a web-based app, and you wanted to do some sort of encryption between a web client that you have and this application, then this is a potential way that, or something we provide to developers that allow you to do that, do the encryption piece of it without having to write, a bunch of cryptographic type of things and having some, person like that on your staff. So we provide this CAPICOM DLL for you to use. In this particular case, a piece of that that component, specifically the CAPICOM.certificates piece of it. And this is used as an ActiveX control and allows you to do encrypting over the web. And that's kind of where the issue lies. So, kind of how this works is in any development situation, third party, ISV out there that you might have, or even internal developers you might have, could have used this component in a product. And and therefore shipped it along with their product to you. So one of the things about this that we want to touch on is that this is something that is used by third-party developers. In Microsoft, there's just one product of ours that we use this that's affected, and that's BizTalk. So folks out there that have BizTalk Server installed in their environments, which is an enterprise product, should get this update done. But everybody out there, if you're wondering if a piece of software that you have might have used this from someone that you got software from, you can run the Microsoft Baseline Security Analyzer, and it will tell you if you have this on there and if you need this update. And as well, if you went to update your system, it should recognize that for you anyway. But if you want to be on the safe side and you really want to know for sure, you can run the Baseline Security Analyzer, and it will tell you if any of the third-party products that you have installed Capicum on your system. And if so, then most certainly download the update and get that installed.
That's good. So let me just kind of divert a little bit here before we wrap it up. I've read recently that this is supposedly May 2007 is supposed to be the month of ActiveX bugs. And there have been a month of other bugs as well. There's a month of Oracle bugs, a month of other kind of bugs and everything else out there. So what is Microsoft going to do about that? Are we getting ready to, are we going to be watching more closely? Is MSRC going to basically be doing the same thing they always do, which is monitor everything 24/7? Can you talk a little bit about that at all?
Sure. So, of course, Microsoft aware of this idea of the month of ActiveX bug, project. And, of course, the issue here, for us is obviously responsible disclosure. And the idea of doing something like this is for folks to go out and find stuff and then publicly disclose them. But the fact that this is happening doesn't change what Microsoft does. Even if things are reported, and we will investigate every one of these and put it through the appropriate process at the MSRC. And for anything that gets found that is valid, we will certainly, like every other bug or vuln that gets found throughout the year, we will address it appropriately and get it into the fix cycle.
Cool. Good. So nothing to be worried about. Okay, well, everybody, I hope that you guys had a great time. Mark, I want to thank you for your time today. And you guys, keep your machines up to date, and I'll talk to you later.
Thanks, Kai.
That was Kai Axford and Mark Riesi on the May 2007 security updates here on TechNet Radio. Remember, the monthly security bulletin webcast is tomorrow, and you can find a link for that on our site as well, microsoft.com/TNradio. The email address here is tnradio@microsoft.com, so let me know what you want to hear. Thanks again for listening to TechNet Radio. I look forward to talking with you next week.
Have comments or want to request a story idea? Call us at 1-877-814-6506.